This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Stephen's Universe edition. It's Wednesday, February 15th, 2017. On today's show, Stephen Universe has gone from being a semi-hidden curio on the Cartoon Network to, as some critics argued, the best show on television. We discussed this animated gem. And then Saturday Night Live, it's suffered a fate that is usually death to satire. It's become venerable, but the institution has found new life and Mondo ratings, making fun of, yeah, that guy. And finally, Slate's series, The Trump Story Project, publishes pieces of fiction, but are now in danger of being uncanny depictions of the alternate reality that we are all now living. Joining me today is Slate's editor, Julia Turner. Hey, Julia.
Hello. From Slate's Washington, D.C. office today.
I was going to ask. Yeah, no, I'm reporting live from the Slate's Ghent studio. Yeah, and of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana, we're all in 3 separate locations right now.
I know. It's sort of fitting for Stephen Universe, as we'll talk about when we get to it. I feel like we should all fuse into one mega being.
Or alternately, with like the sort of Armageddon Damocles hovering over the human race, I think it's important that one member of the Gabfest crew survive, no matter what. So I think doing it from disparate, secret locations may be the way to go.
Yeah, concrete bunker.
Shoot, we just told everybody our locations.
Damn it. You guys. We have worse security than the Trump administration.
Oh, that's true, too. Julia, before we dig in, what sorts of businesses do we have?
First, I want to remind our listeners that we have a live show coming up in Washington, D.C. on April 19th, and tickets for that, I think, will soon be available over this weekend, first for Slate Plus members and then for Slate regular readers and listeners at slate.com/live. And then second, our Slate Plus segment today will be sort of a Quiz Steve segment. We got a listener question on the Facebook page to the effect of, where do I start with philosophy? And so we're going to pose that question to Steve. Dana, perhaps I will pose it to you as well. I certainly will not be answering the question, where do I start with philosophy?
Meaning of life, having, yay or nay.
Having never particularly started, unless you count political theory, which we can get into. So if you are not yet a Slate Plus member, you can join at slate.com/culture plus. Joining will give you access to ad-free Slate podcast feeds, bonus segments of our show and other shows every week, and of course, make you a supporter of Slate and the journalism that we do. Again, that's slate.com/culture plus. All right. What are we talking about?
Steven Universe is an animated show. It's on the Cartoon Network. It comes from the rather remarkable imagination of an animator named Rebecca Sugar. Embarrassed to say, I didn't know who she was. She's the first female showrunner creator on the Cartoon Network. And second, fanboys and fangirls of Adventure Time will recognize her name as a creative contributor to that show. This one tells the tale of a sweet, if somewhat inept, kid and his alien warrior friends who are crystal gems. We'll explain that in a minute. He himself is a son of this semi-mythical creature, a crystal gem crossed with a human, and he's learning to use his own powers of shape-shifting, form-melding, and gender fluidity. The show itself is a fascinating cross of anime, video games, and Saturday morning cartoons. And in the end, it's as much about identity and empathy as anything else. It's even been called a defining example of artistic resistance in the age of Trump. Why don't we listen to a clip?
These are the warps that once connected us to other planets. If something tried to come from space, it would be through here. But wait! This warp pad is broken, marked inactive by the very depressed cartoon breakfast sticker you placed here yourself.
Look, Pearl's right. Like usual. Ugh, you get used to it. Oh man, finally, that took all day.
It was important to make Steven feel secure.
Yes, Steven feels much better now.
I'm a little tired of you guys telling me how I feel. I know I saw something outside the stream.
And I know you didn't.
Why is it so hard to just listen to Steven?
This is new. I kind of like it.
Steven, you just don't know what you're talking about.
It sounds like maybe you don't know what I'm talking about.
Dana, let me start with you. I would describe this show as disorienting, but in the very best possible way. I mean, it's been described as an all-ages show. It certainly is that. You can imagine kids watching it almost like a Saturday morning cartoon. You can imagine cynical hipster dweebs watching it at 4 a.m, and even middle-aged dorks like me getting into it, which I did. All I knew after I'd watched 4 or 5 episodes is I wanted to continue to be lost within its weirdness, but also eventually to orient myself to it, what appears to be quite broad and deep mythologies. What do you make of this show?
Well, you know, I didn't expect to like this show at all for the following reasons. As I've said, I think many times talking about TV series on this podcast, I'm not that into deep mythology shows, you know, shows that have all kinds of strange mysteries that need to be unfurled by watching it all in order, kind of X-Files style. That's just not a style of watching that appeals to me. And secondly, I was afraid, I guess, because like you say, this is popular among both sort of stoner dude types and kids and all kinds of people. I thought it would be like one of those Adult Swim shows, which in general don't appeal to me precisely because they tend to come from a sort of patriarchal point of view that's kind of mean and sexist. And I can't even cite a show for you, but I think you know the spirit I mean, the kind of stoner dude show. And this show was, yes, the deep mythology is there and you need to have some patience to unpack it. And I haven't totally done that yet with the 6 or so episodes I've watched. But it is the opposite of one of those nasty dude stoner shows from Adult Swim. It's really this beautiful kind of dreamy lesbian fantasy about, as you said, gender fluidity and the ability to change your identity into whatever you want. And, you know, the logic of the show proceeds in this strange dreamlike way that you really have to give yourself up to. It's not something you can watch out of the corner of one eye while you're checking your email or something, right? I mean, it's really a show that, in spite of the fact that it's 10 minutes long, and as you say, a child could understand it and engage with it on many levels, there's a lot of complexity there, and it takes really unexpected plot twists.
Yeah, also it's just beautiful. And I say that as someone who really admires, you know, the magical realist beauty of whimsical illustrated landscapes like the ones you might find in a Miyazaki movie. And I think that influence is certainly here. But it combines these beautiful landscapes, which have a combination of like dreamlike block cut landscapes and then kind of very goofy and specific personas and places, with a really unusual narrative structure that combines totally progressive politics, but that are shrugged at rather than made a big deal out of. And that's so much more pleasurable from a narrative perspective. Like, the model here is not Pixar's Brave, where the company is like, oh, shoot, we've never had a female protagonist. Let's make a movie with a female protagonist. And then the plot for that female protagonist is like, oh, shit, I'm the protagonist, but I'm a woman. What a problem. Like, you know, everyone is just modern in their identities and admirable in their empathy for one another. And then that does not deny the story, its conflict and interest and all kinds of unusual alien beasties and emotional beasties that the characters have to deal with. So I was very impressed. I really enjoyed the episodes of the show that I watched.
Me too. I loved it. I watched it with my now just turned 14-year-old daughter, who regards herself as kind of preference indeterminate and fluid, and many of her friends do too, and they don't see that reflected very often in popular media. And as you say, Julie, exactly right. They very often don't see it reflected back to them non-didactically. Creators of shows don't approach that attitude towards life as naturally as they do apparently now, as young people and some very young people do now. It reminded me, as you say, of anime, in that you enter its logic and are disoriented by what by your standards is illogic, but by its standards has a kind of dreamlike coherence to it. I loved that aspect. It reminded me also of an influence Sugar, as far as I know, hasn't really cited, but I'll impose on her and it, which is Henry Darger, the outsider artist who created vast warring universes out of his imagination. Another thing I really want to mention about it is that one of the kind of tutelary gems is voiced by Estelle, who one could listen to reading or saying anything at any length. She has a very captivating English accent, really rich timbred, authoritative voice. I love her character. And then the other thing I would say is that the way music is woven into the storytelling.
Yeah, Stephen, as long as you mentioned the music, I agree. That's really, really a strong point of the show. And the songs, although they're very short and very simple, are all really catchy and really clever. And the first song that I heard that kind of made me start to get into the spirit of Steven Universe was called Giant Woman. It's from the episode Giant Woman from the first season. Just for some background on this song, which also gives you a sense of this matrilineal kind of foundationally queer universe that this show takes place in. The premise of the Giant Woman episode is that two of the gem characters who are Steven Universe's kind of guardians, named Amethyst and Pearl, have the ability to fuse when they want to, when they need to, for some moment of great strength, into one giant woman named Opal, who, as it turns out, is voiced by Amy Mann. And so for the whole episode, Steven Universe is trying to get these two women to fuse and saying, I want to see you become a giant woman. It would be so cool. So let's listen to a clip of this great song, Giant Woman.
Oh, I know it'll be great, and I just can't wait to see the person you are together. If you give it a chance, you could do a huge dance, because you are a giant woman. You might even like being together.
I think we should invite our intern Daniel Schrader onto the show, though, because he is a Steven Universe completist and pushed for us to do this segment. And I have a question for him. Daniel, welcome to the studio.
Thanks for having me. I'm so glad y'all are talking about this. It's such a great show.
I'm so glad that you prompted us to watch this, and I really enjoyed it, and I felt like I clicked with it more than I clicked with a show the last time we attempted to commune with a wildly popular Cartoon Network cartoon that's really for adults. I'm referring there to Adventure Time, which I think we watched and admired and then forgot about. And I'm a little concerned, even though I admired this more and it spoke more deeply to my heart as a feminist and admirer of beautiful landscapes and admirer of clever musicals and funny things, and frankly, gemstones, I'm like a little worried I'm not going to watch it. Like, I really admire and like it, but I'm like not sure it's going to rise to the top of my TiVo. And I'm curious how you discovered it and how it fits into your viewing habits, and like whether you have thoughts on the adult cartoon and how to cultivate your adult cartoon watching self.
Like, the reason it fits in my viewing schedule, because like I just love animation. I really like a lot of anime. I watch Adventure Time. Well, I watched Adventure Time for a long time, though I stalled on that after a while. And I think that part of like why I transferred over to this as like my main cartoon that I go to and look for is because it has all of the pieces of Adventure Time, but also goes further than that. There's an emotional depth to Steven Universe that isn't available in something like Adventure Time, I think. Rebecca Sugar just understands how to check all of the boxes of a great adventure story that has all of the mythology, but also how to tell a well-crafted emotional narrative. And that's actually exemplified most in one arc between Pearl and Garnet fusing, and Pearl and Garnet fuse once, and then Pearl tries to trick Garnet into fusing a couple more times because it is so emotionally fulfilling to be fused. And
by fuse, you mean they turn into one other being,
yes,
right?
Yes, they fuse into another being, and their being is called Sardonyx. And actually, what's interesting is, so Garnet herself is a fusion. She lives every day as a fusion of Ruby and Sapphire, and there's another episode that has that backstory as well that is also, I watched it recently and it just brought me to tears for no reason. It was just so good. They fuse, and then Garnet is horrified when she finds out that Pearl has been tricking her so much, because it's this deeply important thing to Garnet, who lives her life as a fusion, to feel like she is being taken advantage of. But at the same time, from Pearl's perspective, she is so desperate for some type of intimate connection like Garnet's fusion experiences every day, that she doesn't know how else to try and obtain that feeling. And it's just very adult feelings from a child show that make me fall in love.
Is this a child show? Like, I guess I'm having kind of a classification problem in response, and this show is sort of anti-classification, so I'll try and cast aside my desire to classify it. But I found myself watching this show and wishing that my children were the age of your children, Dana and Steve, because I felt like someone who was like between 8 and 15 could get obsessed, and then it could be really fun to watch with them. Like, who does the Cartoon Network conceive of as the audience for the show? Is it for 9-year-olds or 14-year-olds or 40-year-olds, or every, like, is it really for everybody? I'm confused.
I think where it fits in the block of what it's programmed with, so it's programmed along with like Adventure Time and The Amazing World of Gumball and Regular Show, which I believe is ending or has ended. And so it's pitched at both those 8 to 14-year-olds, both ages, but also to my age of like 27-year-old dude who just really likes animation. And I think that it fits in all of those ranges, because for someone like me, who I personally love all of the emotional deep stuff, but then like when I talk to it with my buddies who watch it, they really love the deep, complex mythology of it all. And then when I talk to like my younger cousins who watch it, they really love the just pure fun of it all. So I think it just hits different receptors for different people, but has all of those things available to any viewer.
Well, even though Steven Universe is drawn as a child, he seems to be about 8 to 10 or something like that. It seems to me like more of a tween show. When I think of my 10-year-old daughter watching it, actually, she turns 11 today. Happy birthday.
Happy birthday.
I'm not sure that she would get some of the things that have to do with, for example, gender identity and falling in love. There's a great moment in one episode where Steven and his child friend Connie fuse into a being called Stevani, and they go to this dance together. And the crazy thing about Stevani is she's older than them, right? They fuse into this being. They're both maybe 8 to 10 years old, and this being seems to be a teenager. The teenager goes to a party and gets kind of hit on, and there's this scene of sort of uncomfortable quasi-sexual harassment, and then this moment where she stands up for themselves, and it's something that I think for somebody who's just at the age to start flirting or being harassed or being noticed as a sexual being would be a great empowering episode. You know, Steve, I thought of you because the cartoon show, the much more mainstream cartoon show that I thought of upon first watching this was My Little Pony, which actually has, I mean, I'm talking the current My Little Pony, not the old one that was very sweet and saccharine, but the one that is currently on that has this developing deep mythology.
My Little Pony, Friendship is Magic.
Is Magic, exactly. And in which there are also sort of shrugged off absurdities, like, for example, this dragon character named Spike who burps scrolls. So whenever he belches, you know that some kind of message is coming from Celestia, the queen pony, and it comes out of his mouth and they all read it. So burping scrolls is the kind of thing that would happen in Steven Universe. Anyway, Steve, since I know you're a brony, I thought I'd just share that.
I can neither confirm nor deny any knowledge of what Dana speaks of.
Steve, you've already said on stage at a live show that Twilight Sparkle is your favorite
Dana?
Pony.
Or was silence your mic, please. Silence the crazy woman's microphone. Daniel, thank you so much for coming into the studio. That was fantastic.
Thanks for having me. This was a ton of fun.
The show is Steven Universe. It's on the Cartoon Network, 10-minute bites at a time. If you're not familiar with it, you should be. We'd love to know what you think of it. There are definitely going to be some completists out there in our audience. So come to facebook.com/culturefest. Tell us what you thought. All right, moving on. Saturday Night Live has gone from a counterculture middle finger to an American institution over its decades of existence. And like any such institution, it waxes and wanes in relevance and freshness. But the Trump presidency has given it new creative life and historically high ratings. Alec Baldwin, of course, is thin-skinned, shallow, egomaniacal fool president. Melissa McCarthy is spicy. Kate McKinnon is everybody and anybody in between. The show now dominates late-night satire, as Jon Stewart once did during the Bush years. We're joined to discuss the role of satire in the age of Donald Trump with the wonderful Emily Bazelon, of course, one of the magnificent threesome of the Political Gabfest and a contributor to the New York Times Magazine. Emily, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. You guys always give the most ebullient introductions to your guests. It's very nice. It's like you're starting on a high note. Of course, I may not ever match that high note in what I actually say, but you've set the terms.
Are you accusing me of insincerity?
No,
of untrue sincerity?
That's a lot to live up.
There's no doubt you'll be able to do that, he said with unctuous insincerity. Emily, added to all of what is strange and POMO and funhouse and bizarre about what we're experiencing right now is that, as you watch Saturday Night Live, you are confident that the Mad King is also watching and will tweet about it practically in real time, or if not, certainly by the next day. What on earth are we, supposed to make of the relationship between satire and reality in the age of this preposterous presidency?
Right. Well, as I think this is actually a line from SNL last week, that Trump is the TV president. At the time, I think he was in TV court in a skit on the show. But I think you're right that there's a way in which this particular kind of TV seems like it matters more than a lot of reality matters, and that it's a barometer, right? Like, and that it's a barometer for Trump, or for thinking about the presidency, a lens for seeing the presidency, and the fact that you know that Trump actually cares about it and seems to be thin-skinned about the show's portrayal of him is also part of the kind of intrigue.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of why we were so eager to have you on is because we listened to your conversation about SNL and Trump last week, and your esteemed colleague David Plotz was lamentatious, dismissive, concerned about the gleefulness of the satire on SNL, and I think, expressed the concern that the making other liberals chortle at the craven stupidity of Trump and those around him might not actually be the most politically useful thing to do, and also might, in fact, even be counterproductive. And I think Dana, at least, expressed to me, am I outing you, Dana, that she was like shouting at her headphones from her kitchen table.
My contribution to the conversation would have been after Plotz said that about, is this really what the left wants to do, is make fun of Trump. And I think his idea was also, how are we going to create a coalition? Basically, how are we going to peel off Trump supporters who are slowly realizing, the error of their ways if we keep on making fun of him and by extension anyone who would vote for him? I mean, wasn't that sort of part of the gist of David's argument?
Yeah, I mean, I think David was skipping over the usual defense of satire, which I'm sure, which you should give. But I think he was making a larger point about liberal control of pop culture, of mainstream culture right now, and the way in which that can make the mockery feel alienating in his eyes to Trump supporters. There's a way in which there's a monopoly on the culture's distaste for Trump, and it's not, I think David's point was there are all those people out there who see it differently, and the people who are making television, etc., aren't necessarily the best position to reach them because they seem to just be kind of wanting to take a shower rather than consider
right.
That point of view.
Right. I see his point. I mean, I guess his point was in a way that insofar as Hollywood is, controlled by liberals for the most part, and that's the position that we're assumed to be speaking from when we watch a TV show or go to a Hollywood movie, that it's sort of punching down in a way, in a kind of aesthetic way. It's a punching down to the right. I mean, I guess my only response to that, and this may not be the classic defense of satire, but it's a release of tension. It just seemed to me the idea that satirists, that the creators of Saturday Night Live would have to dial things back or try to reach out or kind of, sort of in some way control their approach to satirizing Trump for some political goal seem to me to just glide over the function of satire as a pure release of energy, you know, and just that we're living under such a strange regime right now. And there's such a sense of powerlessness, and we can call our congressman every day and sign every petition and nobody cares and, nothing's going to change. And that there's this place of kind of libidinal bursting out. And that's what Saturday Night Live represents right now. I mean, the strange thing to me about this new resurgence of Saturday Night Live and under the Trump regime is that it's not even necessarily funny every week. I think it was kind of largely agreed, for example, that last week's episode was kind of a disappointment, but it still feels important, you know, and even some of the skits that are unfunny, for example, the Fatal Attraction skit that was pretty, at least on my Twitter feed, widely derided for being sexist, the Kellyanne Conway as Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction, right? It wasn't that it was funny that mattered. It was that it released a certain kind of pent-up rage. As the Sean Spicer, which to me are the most successful, Melissa McCarthy's Sean Spicer skits, they allow us to kind of scream back at someone that we feel like is screaming at us without us having any voice in it.
I do think the fact that we know Trump is watching does confound how we think about it, though, in really interesting ways. Someone smart in a Slate meeting a couple weeks ago suggested that Trump needed a fool, that like he should have a jester at the at the White House to perform the classic function of, like, you know, flatteringly but comedically presenting his foibles back at him in a way that perhaps he might comprehend. And I don't think SNL has quite taken on that role, but it must be such a head trip to be concocting comedy for an audience of the person whose staff and persona and policies you are satirizing. Like that does confound what they're doing. And I would raise perhaps I don't know if this is the going theory. I do not think this is the politically most astute version of Saturday Night Live that we have ever had. And I think it's too bad. Like, I think some of the performers on Saturday Night Live now are some of the best that have ever been on the show. And I think that the increasing diversity of the cast is a huge asset to the show and allows it to cover territory and do really fascinating, interesting, funny, provocative things that it never would have been able to do before, and things that feel particularly vital at this moment. But just the acuity of its political touch is a little broad. Like the Kellyanne Conway sketch, I think, is a case in point. Like, Kate McKinnon is doing heroic work portraying this vital, mysterious figure in the Trump organization, but she's a different Kellyanne Conway in every sketch. I mean, maybe that's the conceit of the send-up, is like, you know, she's so impossible to figure out. SNL can't even decide if she's a apologetic, harried suburban mom or a sex-crazed psychopath bitch fiend or just a fame whore. Like, they can't settle on an interpretation, and maybe that's just a metaphor for how bewildered we all are by this person. But I feel like in some ways the insights aren't quite up to the level of scrutiny that the show is getting from everybody.
Huh. So, I mean, I guess the obvious test of satire is whether it's funny or not, right? And we shouldn't, like, completely skip past that. I'm going to defend McKinnon's Kellyanne Conway, including this week. I mean, I don't really care if it's consistent or not. I just want it to make me think about what's happening in some way, even if I think it's like off base. I think there's something about her different characterizations at different moments. I think maybe the most successful ones are when she just has like 1 second to roll her eyes when she's portraying Conway in the office with Trump. And I think the glory of Melissa McCarthy's send-up of Sean Spicer is that it makes it clear that Spicer is playing the fool in a lot of ways in the White House, that Trump already has that character. So anyway, I guess my job wasn't really to defend the show on this show, but I do think that, it's so hard. I mean, they are performing at such a high level. What we want from them is, you know, amazingly classic comedy that's to the standard of when John Belushi and Eddie Murphy were doing their amazing SNL. There's always that like high bar for them. And of course they're not going to meet it every week, but are they providing the release that Dana was talking about to their audience? I think they probably are. And then there's this other question, which you can either bat away as irrelevant or grapple with, which is reaching their audience in that rage-filled release way something that has political utility right now? And maybe that's not a fair test for the show.
Yeah, I don't think political utility is the grounds on which you should judge a comedy show. I wish Plots were here to make the case that it were.
Well, I'll make a version of the case, and maybe I'm not characterizing him fairly, but because I used to believe it about The Daily Show, I thought that that was really driven home when Colbert and Stewart did the rally in Washington, D.C., which fell completely flat, in part because at the moment that you might have done something kind of galvanic and identity making about the people who'd been laughing along with them for the better part of 10 years, they couldn't muster it. That you know, in a way, it did seem to be a coping mechanism and an aspirin in the age of, you know, political absurdity and ill-begotten wars. And that to me was quite depressing. I think actually something totally dissimilar is going on right now with Saturday Night Live, because Trump is so completely anomalous himself. And the old idea was that, you know, coastal elites laugh at and laugh down at and talk down to and behind the backs of ordinary people. And this was a caricature that really helped neuter the left in a way by using a kind of social characterization of the typical, you know, latte sipping snob as the left winger. And I think that the energy there has reversed completely, that if you can't see the manifest absurdity and frankly kind of anti-Americanism of this administration, you don't really deserve to have an opinion about who or what I am. And I think that this is that what SNL is doing right now is far more continuous with the women's marches the day after the inauguration, which suddenly made people aware that we're done fucking saying we're sorry. We're done apologizing for the foamed milk in our coffee as if that's the relevant, you know, issue here. And I think SNL is reinforcing that in a obviously a much more jagged and satirical and, you know, jaggedly cutting way, but kind of the same effect. It's if you can't look at our public life right now and see that these people are clowns, hypocrites, lying, travesting the Constitution, and seem to have an end game of repealing liberal democracy, I don't really give a shit if you don't like my choice of white wine. Like, screw you.
That's the release I'm talking about. Exactly the release that I'm talking about. It's a psychological function more than a political one, right?
But I think that psychological function has a political consequence.
Absolutely.
Which is very binding and very animating, and it's continuous with a desire to fight, not a desire to be superior and laugh and then switch it off and go back to, you know, a status quo ante.
But Steve, what you just said is about feeling superior. I mean, the like working oneself up into the lather of like, if they can't see, well, fuck them, which is like, it's just, there are a lot of people who don't see Trump that way. And fuck them.
Yeah, I'm not negotiating a common reality with someone who can look at Donald Trump and not see, who can hear the words President Trump and not experience an oxymoron, who can look at the Flynn situation and say that the problem is the media leaked this. I mean, I'm done negotiating that common reality. I don't care if I'm above or below the person I'm not negotiating with anymore. In my estimation, that person is an enemy of the American Republic. I am no longer in dialogue with them. And by the way, I would feel less secure saying this, Emily, if the Gallup polls didn't demonstrate a 15-point advantage to my side as well. He is leaking the people who voted for him, and certainly by this point has probably leaked a large plurality, if not a majority, of the people who voted for him and Obama. And, you know, so I mean,
and it's going to be a long slog until 2018. I know this presidency seems endless, but we're less than a month in, and if you want to change the political landscape in the country, which I know you do, the idea that like enough folks are going to come over because they see how, you know, incredibly, amazingly ludicrous this presidency is, and that's going to turn the tables. I mean, you could be right, but it also seems to me that it is a real failure of empathy to write off every single Trump supporter right now. I mean, this was such a polarizing election, right? And people felt that they were making a choice that mattered to them. And so it's going to take a while. And for a lot of people, it's going to be about circumstances of their own lives, how they feel about the well-being of the country and the economy. It's not going to be Michael Flynn as much as you might want it to be. And so I just feel like there is a sense of derision toward Trump supporters as well as toward Trump, which is not going to serve the American polity well in the end.
But I do think it's important to acknowledge we've crossed several shocking Rubicons. And one way to normalize that is to say this is a Republican Democrat or left right divide in some traditional spectrum way. And it's not. We're off of that spectrum. We're now talking about, you know, people who have a fundamental understanding of empirical reality and the Constitution. And if you're on the wrong side of that divide, I don't owe you a kind of good German condescending, oh, that's fine, that's just your point of view. And I just want to be totally clear that I prefer Sancerre to Chardonnay.
Steve, is there any room between, you know, I don't owe you like the condescending, I respect your point of view, and I'm still interested in trying to understand where you come from and think about how I might get you to think about this a little differently?
The problem with that, Emily, is that in order for me to have that conversation in the first place, a person has to have a sufficiently liberal, in the most expansive definition of the term, attitude towards dialogue and reality, right? That in essence, I haven't already been, I mean, just think about the categories into which a quote unquote liberal in the narrower sense is placed before they even open their mouth, right? In that kind of a dialogue. Yes, if I could actually have that conversation with someone whose point of view wasn't so rigidified and preformed prior to the discussion, that I might think there might be movement. But I mean, liberals, the entire worldview is based on the idea that they bring that suppleness to dialogues with others. And we've been screwed by that presumption over and over and over again. And one feature of self-respect is saying is enough is enough.
In the interviews I've done with Trump supporters since the election, and just in talking to people, I think there's more play in the joints there than you're giving people credit for. That their reasons, this notion that they're all rigidified or that they're all one thing, I just think is wrong from my conversations with people. Mm-hmm. And we need to make some room for finding each other across what feels like this enormous political divide.
Yes, I actually completely agree with that.
I agree, Emily, that there's going to have to be at some point some common language that we find, right, from these two sides of the divide. Maybe not that we're going to peel people away even, but that at least we can have the fight on some grounds that we all agree on the terms. But mm-hmm. I don't think that the way to do that in any way, I think you would probably all agree on this, is to muzzle our satire. I mean, I don't think the way to do that is to, as Sean Spicer said, they've crossed over into mean, right, when Melissa McCarthy started playing him on the show. I don't think that listening to that kind of voice and essentially neutering satire in order to make it less offensive to those it's satirizing is the way that any of that dialogue gets started.
Emily Bazelon, there's no unction or insincerity here. It is a total pleasure to have you on the show. I hope we do it again soon.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Since the election, we've all read 100 think pieces about what the next 4 years might hold. But fiction has a special power to clarify, galvanize, prophesy, and warn. So writes Ben H. Winters, the acclaimed novelist, most recently of the Times bestseller Underground Airlines, on Slate Magazine for the Trump Story Project. Ben now joins us. Ben, this was originally fully a counterfactual exercise in the anticipation that Hillary Clinton was going to win. You were going to publish a series of short stories. What if Trump had won? They were meant to be fanciful. Now they're turning into a kind of reality. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the inception of the project and how it's been executed?
Well, actually, to the contrary, this idea really appeared after the election. Like immediately, along with a lot of people, I think I felt a kind of despair and shock, you know, in the immediate aftermath. But along with that, this very familiar feeling of like, it was so surreal, you know, it felt like we had entered this alternate reality. It really did. And it was familiar to me because I've read a lot of books like that. And I've also had recently written one. And it occurred to me that one way of kind of thinking about what was about to happen. You know, this was in December. You know, this is before the inauguration. One way of thinking about what was about to happen, what was going on, one way of kind of processing the shock and also, I guess, thinking through what needed to be done now was in fiction, was in this kind of very specific genre of speculative fiction.
Why don't you describe how you chose the writers, who they are, and what the range of selections is?
It was really important to me to find a reach of artists who representing both sort of a diversity of the kinds of authors who are out there in terms of genre. So I wanted to find some science fiction folks, some fantasy folks, some of what we just call sort of straight literary fiction folks. One of the nice things about being a writer is that you get to know a lot of writers, and also you have this weird license to just email other writers and say, introduce yourself and explain what you're doing. And I found that as I think had struck me, that this shocking election result felt like a kind of a point of, besides being a point of despair, also kind of a point of inspiration. I think a lot of writers were also feeling like, oh God, how can I approach this? What can I write? What will be both kind of exciting to me as an artist and also feel like I am doing something? You know, in that sense, we all had and all still have that is motivating a lot of political action, a lot of calling up Congress people, a lot of marching, a sense of I need to be doing something right now. And writers want to write. So I did, you know, and I found folks like Niecy Shaul, who is a wonderful speculative fiction author, who had a book called Everfair last year. A big sort of sprawling, super smart work of speculative fiction set in Africa. And Hector Tobar, who lives here in LA, who he wrote a wonderful nonfiction book about the Chilean miners, but he's also an extraordinary novelist. And Saladin Ahmed, who is a science fiction writer and a poet, and Elizabeth Baer, and Eden Lepecki, whose book California garnered a lot of praise a couple years ago. So just, I really wanted to find a lot of different kinds of minds, you know, to see how different people would take on this particular moment in time. I pitched it out as, look, I want to think about all the different ways that our country and our world might change in the next 4 years. And not just as a matter of politics, but also as a matter of like emotional tone, you know, because that's what is so interesting about novels like this and stories like this, is they allow you to try to feel what the world will feel like, not just what it will look like, but it will feel like had things been different.
Oh, I think you just answered my question. I mean, I was going to sort of ask what prompt you gave them, you know, how extensive your suggestions were to them, or if you just sort of said, you know, Trump administration, go.
It was a slightly more extensive than that, but not much more. I basically said, you know, feel free to think about one specific area of interest to you. You know, so there are environmental concerns, there are concerns about a reproductive choice, there are concerns about immigration, obviously. Some folks sort of took it as, I'm going to think about what will happen to America if Roe v. Wade is overturned. And Eden Lepecki's story is a good example of that. It's about a group of young women who sort of take it upon themselves to provide abortion services. Lauren Bweckes, who's a wonderful kind of speculative novelist, she writes horror and mystery stuff, and she created this, which we haven't run yet, but we will shortly, this kind of what she calls the Patriot Points Reward Program, where you're filling out a questionnaire to see if you are truly an American and truly fit in the new America. So that's a sort of work of high satire. And then Niecy Shaul's story, you know, she imagined the resistance, and she sort of thought through a kind of communitarian political underground organization, which to me is one of the most sort of hopeful and exciting stories. It's called The Slipper Net. We haven't run it yet, but we will shortly, about like what is it going to look like over the next few years? Because we're in this very exciting political moment right now, people trying to figure out what part they want to play in pushing back against this new world.
One thing that's been striking about reading these in the context of the first not quite month of the Trump administration is how swiftly the real world became extreme and apocalyptic. Like, I think when I look back on what some of my concerns were about the Trump administration coming in, they were around the impact that Trump's appointees and his administration broadly would have on all the groups of people that he maligned and threatened on the way into office. But I think I also was not anticipating how broadly and loudly and quickly the administration would do things like threaten green card holders with the inability to travel or return to their families, the level of egregiousness of the early assaults on rights from the Trump administration has actually catapulted the sense of what the country feels like now into realms that feel apocalyptic and practically fictional. And I think that extremity of action has really spurred an extreme response. But it's been interesting to note, too, how these stories pick different moments, some relatively soon in the future, some further in the future, to look back, and the pieces are really illuminating.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? You don't realize how quickly things can change, not just sort of in terms of the political realm, but in the way the world feels. And like, I mean, I published my novel Underground Airlines last year, you know, mid last year, and it's about the legacy of slavery and how America is still so screwed up around its treatment of its African American citizens, and how the, you know, things like the right to vote are just the right of freedom of movement and to be free from police violence are still so fragile. And like, it's gotten worse. Suddenly we have Jeff Sessions as the Attorney General, someone who's spent a lifetime campaigning against the right to vote. And like, it's like we don't realize how, I guess we didn't realize, or we didn't want to realize how fragile the sort of membrane is between the things we take for granted, the world that we take for granted, and something that is much, much worse. And so like, even in the time between my calling for these stories and folks starting to write them and the time now that we are publishing them, which was like a 2-month, you know, or a 6-week window, things have changed so dramatically that I've gotten emails from people being like, wait, my story didn't run yet. Can I update, you know, can I change this? Can I make it, you know?
it wasn't dystopic enough, right? Exactly. I got to up the dystopianism a bit.
and events on the ground are moving so rapidly. It's astonishing. It's astonishing. You know, Hector Tobar's story was the first one we ran. It was in the week of the inauguration, and it was about, it's called The Daylight Underground, and it's about the mass deportation of undocumented immigrants to the United States. And it was very shortly after that that we had the first of the EOs, the executive orders dealing with, well, let's start to clean this up. Let's start to get these folks out of here. Let's start to prevent folks from coming in. And like, our worst dystopian imaginings are suddenly being fulfilled, you know, or at least, you know, they're making their every effort to fulfill them. And we are seeing people resist.
Well, Ben, I sincerely hope that you don't have to update your story because reality has overtaken it. Let me just quote the sentence that really grabbed me. My execution is in 10 minutes and the crowd is getting excited. Why don't you talk a little bit about your contribution to the project?
Thank you. So my story is called Fifth Avenue. And I sort of took as the pivot point for mine the time when Trump early on in his campaign announced in a speech that he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and not lose any votes. So fervent was his base of support. And so I set my piece during the re-election campaign, and the hero of my story is a journalist who is in a cage waiting to be shot by the president on Fifth Avenue as a big campaign stunt, because he is now threatened by the insurgent James Mattis campaign. And so I think mine actually is one of the most traditional. If you can say that the alternate history genre has its traditions, mine is in that tradition, where I've really imagined out or tried to map out what some of the political events will be between now in 2017 and then in 2020. And I give a kind of capsule summary of American politics between now and then, as it has impacted the life of this journalist who put himself on the emoluments beat. And he's been looking up, you know, he's been following stories about political corruption, and now it has come to this.
Reading the Eden Lapucky story Chorus, which is imagine sort of a world of underground abortion providers, actually in the Pence presidency. It assumes that Trump's been ousted, but that the Pence presidency that has been ushered in is not so great for women either. And in it, the anonymous women who get abortions are referred to as Martha. They're all called Martha. And I believe that in Handmaid's Tale, one of the kind of archetypal female figures, like the women who are not designed for marriage or reproduction, but I think just for housework, are called the Marthas. So I liked the reappropriation of the Marthas in that story.
Yes. Yeah. And I think you're exactly right. They're like the household servant characters in Handmaid's Tale. And I think that, and Eden is a wonderful writer. And I think that story is very powerful. And I think it is very much evoking Handmaid's Tale. And I think that, like, we are playing with a literary tradition here. Books like The Handmaid's Tale, obviously, like Philip Roth's The Plot Against America, Philip K. Dick's, The Man in the High Castle. There are these wonderful novels that ask us to imagine a world that is different enough from our world to be kind of to hold its own fascination, but similar enough to kind of scare us, to terrify us, and to make us think about what's going on. Another one that got some interest during the campaign, besides The Plot Against America, and then there's the Sinclair Lewis, It Happened Here, and Octavia Butler's The Parable of the Talents. People were tweeting about it over the summer because she has a character in that book who is a kind of evangelical politician who raves about making America great again. So the kind of prescience of authors in imagining out various dystopian scenarios, had America or if America should go a different way, was definitely part of what inspired this idea, this set of stories.
Ah, well, now prescience and actual dystopia run side by side and parallel to one another. It's absolutely terrifying. It's very riveting.
I will also say, while we have Ben here, that I am certain I've endorsed Ben's book on our show. Underground Airlines is it's an amazing read and a really provocative set of ideas about how bad things would be if slavery had not ended, and also how similar that bad outcome is to some aspects of our world in 2016 and even more so in 2017. So if you have not read it, and I know listeners to Slate Podcast were browbeaten by other podcasts as well to read this book, it's time. You should read it.
Ben Winters, thank you so much for coming on the show and talking about the Trump Story Project.
Thank you so much.
All right, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse Dana. What do you have?
Well, my endorsement this week springs like Athena from the head of Zeus from my endorsements last week. If you remember, I endorsed two Twitter feeds. One was the feed of Rithi Pan, who's a Cambodian filmmaker, and the other was that of Rabi Amaluddin, who's a novelist and essayist. And as it happens, this week in The New Yorker, Rabi Amaluddin, the second of those two recommendations, has a piece on Trump and the era of Trump that is really in a moment when we're inundated with all kinds of, written thoughts about this crazy new thing that's happening to our country, is one of the best things that I've read so far about Trump and Trumpism. It's called Our Part in the Darkness, and it appears in the February 5th issue of The New Yorker. It's by Rabi Amaluddin.
That sounds fantastic. Julia, what do you have?
I have a Prince-related endorsement, because why not have a Prince-related endorsement any week that you can? There are two occasions for having a Prince endorsement this week, not that one needs an occasion. But he was honored on the Grammys on Sunday night, and also on Grammy Sunday, his songs returned to streaming services like Spotify. They had come down, I think, a couple years ago. But a couple years before that, Prince guest starred on an episode of The New Girl, and in that show, in that episode, one of the settings was a party at Prince's house, and Prince created a playlist for what would be played at that party because he did not want the show to misrepresent what kind of musical vibes would be happening at his party. So while you are checking out Prince's catalog on streaming services, you should also mosey over to the many, many playlists on Spotify that are called something like Prince's New Girls Party Playlist, Prince's Party Playlist, New Girls. Twitter personality and tech guy Anil Dash was one of the people who saw the list, which I think was originally published in New York and turned it into a Spotify playlist. So we'll post one of those on our show page. But check out Prince's Party Playlist along with his songs. He, as you will not be surprised to learn, was a pretty great DJ.
That sounds truly incredible. Can you give us a couple of song titles from it?
Curtis Mayfield, Wild and Free, Soul Children, Don't Take My Sunshine. It's just a good mix of stuff. People you want to hear from, but not necessarily the thing you would have thought to put on yourself.
All right, I'm going to go full obscurantist in honor of our forthcoming Slat Plus section, but I wanted to endorse a book by a philosopher whose work I've mentioned before. The philosopher is Christine Korsgaard. She's not only alive, she's doing her best and great work right now. She teaches at Harvard, professor at Harvard. Her book is called Self-Constitution, Agency, Identity, and Integrity. This may seem obscure. It shouldn't. She's a neo-Kantian. She's reviving Kant for the modern age in ways that to me are completely and utterly relevant to our lives. She says something along the lines of, this is not a quote, these are from my own notes on her work on the book, but it's only in considering our actions in the light of reason that our lives become fully chosen things and that we become authors of ourselves. Anyway, to which I would just add that to the extent that philosophy is just an attempt to come up with a working definition of what it is to be a human being, which nobody can do successfully, which is why we need more and more philosophy. She's come up with one that I think revives a notion of reason giving, of being accountable to other human beings in the common and public space of reason. That her idea essentially is that when you provide a reason for an act, you tie both your conception of yourself as an agent and your conception of life to what it is you do in the world. And in so doing, an act becomes something more than just a mere act. Like anyone can move a rock or throw a baseball or whatever. An act becomes an action, and that something is authored by you, and you become a self-author or a full being in the world. There are a number of ways to get at why this is moving, but one of which to me is that it competes directly with a very economics-based notion of the human being as a self-maximizer. That over the last 20 or 30 years, the really dominant mode of thinking of ourselves as human has been neo-Darwinian, right? We're survival machines, we're DNA transmitting machines, almost zombie-like in the telling of Richard Dawkins, or according to Austrian economists and Chicago economists, we're just attempting to rationally self-maximize, and all of what counts as reason is subsumed under that definition. And the best working definition of being human that competes directly with that, in fact, negates it, is Korsgaard's. And she actually talks about that, why that can't possibly be what we mean when we say that we're reasoning beings in the world. It has much more to do with creating a self that is accountable to others in a perspicuous way. That's what reason giving is. And if you're not doing that, in a lovely phrase, she says, you're what Aristotle called a mere heap. And now that we appear to be ruled by people who are mere heaps, coming up with a notion of what it is to be a responsible, self-authored human being seems to me quite a moving and quite a relevant project. So anyway, her name is Christina Korsgaard, professor at Harvard. And the title of the book is Self-Constitution, Agency, Identity, and Integrity, one of the best books I've read in a decade. All right. Thanks, Dana.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Julia.
Thanks.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page, slate.com/culturefest. And you can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our intern is Daniel Schrader. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lichtai, and Andy Bowers is the chief content officer of the Panoply Network. The Culture Gap Fest is part of the Panoply Network, and you can check out an entire roster of really quite amazing shows at panoply.fm. Our Twitter feed is @SlateCultFest. For Julia Turner and Dana Stevens, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you soon. Fighting what is wrong across the world as well as home. But respect for everybody's right could be really out of sight.